Welcome to another Zoom edition of the Purple Knights podcast. We're here today, or I'm here today, with Kristen Schumler, who's a Minneapolis-based historian, and she researches, writes, and gives tours about places associated with Prince and the Minneapolis Sound. So welcome, Kristen.
Thank you, Chris. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, if you would, please give us some background on yourself and how you came to be associated with your Prince research.
Sure. Well, like many people of my age, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s and being of that MTV generation, I just remember from the first time I saw Prince, which was, for me, the Little Red Corvette video, and I just was enthralled, and I just remember thinking, who is this beautiful creature? Who is this person who just seems to not even be of this world? And just loved everything about what I saw in his videos and his, heard in his music. You know, I lived in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is it's a capital town, but it's, you know, not a very big town, not a very diverse town. And to steal a line from Pee Wee Herman's Big Adventure, you know, we had both kinds of music, country and Western. So when I saw Prince and everything else that was coming on MTV, I just, you know, sort of instantly loved him. I really sort of stayed a fan throughout most of my life, but I did sort of, you know, sort of dip in and out of sort of following his career and all of that. So I wouldn't say I'm like, was a super diehard fan, like I've compared to some people I met, but his music just always resonated with me. I always loved it. At the time of his passing, I think most people was just in shock. Being a Minneapolis resident, I just always assumed he would be here. He would always, you know, there is this thing about sort of taking opportunities and people for granted, and Prince just seemed like somebody who would always be here. And so I, like many people, struggled with what to do with the sorrow and the sadness. I'm not artistic, I'm not really musical. But shortly after his passing, I was working on a project. I'm a, like you mentioned, a historian, archaeologist. I study projects to see if they're going to affect historic properties, things that are significant for the National Register of Historic Places. And shortly after his passing, the Star Tribune ran an article saying, here's Prince's childhood home, 539 Newton Avenue North, where he wrote his first song at the age of 7, which is, you know, possibly a very apocryphal story, but it was in one of my project areas. So I had to look at it to see, did this meet criteria? Was it a historic property? And with the, in this case, the Blue Line Transit project that was proposed, you know, affect it. Like most things with Prince, it was not an easy process or a clear answer to the question about, was this historic? I very quickly found out that that was not his childhood home. It was his father's home, and Prince certainly lived there, but it was later in his life when he was a teenager. Knowing that Prince grew up somewhere in the neighborhood, I set off on this journey to find where his childhood home was. And when I did find that, I found I couldn't stop. I was just so fascinated by the places that made Prince, where he grew up, what, you know, economic, social factors were, you know, present in his upbringing here in Minneapolis, which is very different than mine. And it just led to me trying to figure out that historic journey that he made from Minneapolis's north side to Paisley Park to the world. And through that time, identified over 50 properties up to the building of Paisley Park, some that people knew about. I mean, it's not like, you know, I was the first one to ever find some of them, but some were tricky to really find the correct place. So it just really became intellectually, I was very curious, but emotionally, I just felt like this was a way for me to sort of exercise that grief and hopefully give something that could contribute to other Prince fans, whether it's for scholarly knowledge or just so they can come to the Twin Cities in Minneapolis and go stand in what is the actual childhood home instead of, you know, a different one. So that's what started me in this study.
Nice. And was there any particular project or place that you found in the course of doing your research that sort of blew your mind or surprised you in any way?
Let me think. I don't know about blowing my mind. I think there were two that were really fun to find. So as a historian, I try and use primary sources. So those would be things, you know, like a city directory that lists addresses and people associated with them, or, you know, property deeds or marriage certificates. Because while talking to people who were there is absolutely critical, that is another source of primary information. We all know that memory can be not perfect, right? So for a long time, I had identified the Moonsound Studio incorrectly. I had it at this house in the basement of the house on Stevens Avenue, which it really was Moonsound Studio at one point. But I had relied on sort of secondary sources, something like just a web search saying, oh, this is where Prince recorded with Chris Moon. And then I eventually realized I should really check this with some primary sources. Luckily, I became friends with Chris Moon on Facebook, and I asked him, you know, is that where you and Prince recorded together? And he said, no, Prince was never at that studio on Stevens Avenue. And I said, well, where did you record? And he's like, well, I can't remember the address. So I remembered him telling a story. I'm sure you've read this. It's often quoted about how Andre Simone, you know, who played bass, Morrissey, who played drum, and Prince went to Moonsound to record some demos. And they took a break, and Morris and Andre went across the street to a Baskin Robbins 31 flavors ice cream shop while Prince hung back. And Chris, that's when he heard, you know, that Prince was a multi-instrumentalist, and Chris thought, I could work with him to record my songs. And he, you know, sort of made that proposition about come to the studio and you can, you know, I'll teach you how to do recordings. Well, I thought about that reference to the Baskin Robbins. So I went to the city directories and looked at all the Baskin Robbins in 1976 in Minneapolis. And there was only one in the general Nokomis neighborhood. So I knew where the ice cream shop was. Now I had to figure out what was nearby. So I went down to that area and I took a bunch of pictures of a bunch of different possible locations, sent them to Chris Moon and Facebook. And all I got back was like thumbs down. He would be like, nope, that's not it. Nope, that's not it. And so I went back and there was this tiny little, it looks like it probably was a grocery store at some point, like one of those small neighborhood grocery stores. And I took a picture of that and I sent it to him and he sent me a thumbs up. So I knew I had finally found the right Moonsound Studio. You know, the first one, Prince was never at. The third one was demolished to make way for housing development or something. So this one is really critical for that association of the connection between Prince and Chris Moon. So that was fun.
Very, very, very cool. Yeah. I mean, I could see where that would give you chills, because that's the place I assume where they worked on Prince's first single in 1978, which was Soft and Wet, which Chris Moon co-wrote. So it's a very, very historically significant place. And what was the second place? You mentioned there were two that stood out to you.
So, you know, he lived at the France Avenue house after he got his contract with Warner Brothers. And then a lot of biographies talked about how he moved to someplace out west. And, you know, there's sort of this reference to Lake Minnetonka, but there was never any exact address. So the lovely people who run the Prince Vault, I've been in contact with them as I've been trying to figure stuff out, or as I find stuff, I share it with them so they can put it into the vault. They knew I was looking for this property, and they found a, on an auction site, there was a letter addressed to Prince notifying him that he had been nominated for some awards, and it was sent to this address, 680 Mound, 680 North Arm Avenue in Mound. It's the name of the town in Minnesota. So I called the city of Mound and I said, I would like to, you know, look at your property files for this address. Well, it turns out that that address, even though it's in the postcode for Mound, it's actually in the city of Orono. So they sent me to the city of Orono and they said, yep, we have a property file on that house. So I drove out there on the shores of Lake Minnetonka and went through the property files, and there was a city sewer inspection record that says that the renter, Prince Nelson, had called the city to complain about problems with the sewer system in this house. And if you remember those stories from Don Batts talking about recording Dirty Mind, you know, they talked about having to put the sandbags around the sump pump because they were trying to do the recording and they were getting all this backflow and stuff. So I was able to, you know, exactly identify which house and location he recorded Dirty Mind. Now, the sad thing is that the house is no longer the house where he recorded it. Shortly after Prince moved out, I think it was like in 82, there was a fire at the house, and it's now been completely rebuilt. And that is the sort of tragedy of what I've been learning, even though so many of these properties aren't all that old. About 60-65% of what I found are either completely demolished or have been dramatically altered like that, you know, completely rebuilt, even though it's in the same location, in the same general style. So there's, in my mind as a historic preservationist, there is an urgency to identify these places so that they can be protected. I truly believe that Paisley Park is amazingly significant property for its association with Prince. But if all that exists of Prince in 100 years is Paisley Park, and we don't have those places in Minneapolis that connect him and tell, again, that historic journey that he made, I think Prince won't make as much sense. Keeping that connection to Minneapolis is really, really critical.
Right, right. It makes total sense. And again, with that site that you talked about, the Dirty Mind House, I mean, Dirty Mind, in a lot of fans' minds, that was the album where Prince officially became Prince.
Absolutely.
As far as, you know, the persona and all that. So, again, a very, very historically significant place. Very cool that you're involved in the effort to preserve places like this. And while we've got the opportunity here, let's welcome Dr. Kirsty Faircloth of Manchester Metropolitan University. Am I saying that right?
You are. Hello.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. And we were going to talk a little bit about the Purple Rain Interdisciplinary Conference in May of 2017 that you put on in the UK.
Yeah.
And also the follow-up conference, which is very near approaching, Prince 78 to 88, which will be a virtual conference. So, and I believe there are still some spots open for tickets for that. Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah, you can go to the Prince 78288 website and you can still book some free tickets to join the 3-day conference right there.
Okay, so Dr. Fairclough, would you please tell us a little bit about the work that you do and your general history as an admirer of Prince?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm really thrilled to be here. And I've been working closely with Kristen, as you are probably aware, and also Mike Aline from Middle Tennessee State University. And Mike and I's association really began about five or six years ago now. And I was working quite a lot in the States and in Tennessee in particular with my job in the UK. I was kind of setting up a number of partnerships in different universities. And Mike and I really kind of connected over our mutual love for Prince. And I've been a kind of scholar of popular culture for 20 years. I've been teaching film studies, media studies for all of that time, been an avid fan of Prince since my early teens. And I was really struck, even before he passed, as to why there wasn't much scholarship out there on him. I've always found it really surprising. And I remember I always thought to myself, one day I'll kind of channel this fandom and also my, you know, kind of critical training as an academic, and I'll write something on Prince. And I always thought that. And then when he passed, it was really the catalyst for it. And I just thought, I have to do this. I have to put on this conference. And I couldn't find a conference that had happened at all on Prince. I know there was I think it was Black Star by Bowie and Prince that had happened earlier, I think that in 2017, I think, but I might be wrong on the dates there, so forgive me. But there was nothing really, nothing focused solely on Prince. I could not understand it. So I thought, well, it's now or never, you know, there's no better time than now, you know, to focus on his incredible career and his incredible impact on popular culture. So I basically persuaded the University of Salford, where I was at the time, if I could put this 3-day conference on. But I wanted to ensure that I engage with the fans, because it's great if academics talking to academics. That's great. That's what we do in our field. But for someone who studies popular culture, you have to, I felt, engage with the fandom. It's important. It was important as well, of course, because he passed. I felt like we needed a space to talk about Prince and all of his kind of, you know, the multifaceted dimensions of his career and his life. So that's what we did. We worked together, Mike and I, to put the conference on. We had Des Dickerson over, who was living in Nashville at the time. I think maybe still is. He came over to be the keynote. We had 64 papers in 3 days. It was intense kind of appreciation and kind of critique of Prince's career. We also had screenings in the art cinema in Manchester. We made sure that it was it was very much open to the public. And it was a really strange time, I have to say, Chris, because what happened was that the 2 days before the conference happened, we had people flying in from Australia, New Zealand, the United States, all over the world, from many people from Europe. It was the Ariana Grande attack on the Manchester Arena concert, the Ariana Grande concert, and the awful situation that happened there. So it was a very, very strange moment, because we were told effectively there'd been a terrorist attack on the Manchester Arena at the Ariana Grande concert, and we couldn't go ahead with any of our plans. So I had people from all over the world in Manchester wanting to celebrate Prince's life and legacy, and we were told, the police said, we can't do it. We just can't. Things are too. It was a very tense situation. No one quite knew what was going on, because many people lost their lives that day, and it was a terrible series of events. But then things quickly kind of started to shift, and we were then told by the university, actually, we can go ahead. So it was such an intense moment. There was all these people, Prince fans, Prince community coming together, all these scholars. The situation in Manchester was very, very extreme. And Manchester's a city that's built on music and also built on resilience and kind of overcoming difficult times. So it was the coming together of some very unusual circumstances. And in many respects, I feel like that kind of bonded a lot of people. We bonded over Prince over those 3 days, but we also kind of came together because of what had actually happened. And everyone was, the whole city was kind of in a deep state of grief, and it was a very unusual situation, but it did bring us together. And I've had the absolute pleasure of getting to know so many of the Prince fans and scholars that came to Manchester that those few days. And now here we are, you know, 4 years later, and we're about to host the next conference. And of course, I desperately wanted to be back in Minneapolis because I've been there a number of times now and wanted to be there with Kristen and Mike and the rest of the team. It's not to be, but we're still going to have a brilliant, you know, 3 days celebrating the first, yeah, the 78 to 88, which is the, you know, we're calling it the first decade, the looking at the real way in which Prince emerged from Minneapolis and how he cemented his kind of place on the world stage from the early roots. So I'm thrilled to be hosting it and working with Kristen and Mike, and hopefully you will hear some amazing papers. We know we've got some great speakers who also spoke at the 2017 conference and some new speakers as well. So it's going to be a great few days. That's a very long-winded way of saying come to the conference.
that's great. And I just want to say that I appreciate the work that people like yourself and Kristen and Mike and everybody else, all the other Prince scholars throughout the world through these past, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
I appreciate all the work that you guys have done and all the stuff that has come out related to Prince Academia is very, very fascinating stuff. And it's very fulfilling and very exciting to see. As a hardcore fan, I'm pretty much a baby when it comes to being a Prince fan, because I'm only 41 years old. Hmm. But I've been a Prince fan technically since the age of 3.
Yeah.
If you can believe it.
Wow.
Some little red Corvette on the radio station in I believe I was in Gaithersburg, Maryland at the time, but I can't remember exactly. It's been years ago, but that was my first exposure to Prince, and I've been a fan ever since. Purple Rain really cemented my diehard status the next year. I remember wearing out the vinyl in my brother's bedroom on his record player. But all the Academia that's come out since he's passed is very important, and it's a very it's very enriching to his lasting legacy as a man and as an artist. So I greatly appreciate all the work that everybody has done throughout these past few years in terms of Academia. It's very fascinating stuff. So I'm really looking forward to the 78 to 88 conference. And I actually presented at the 2018 conference, which I know Kristen did as well, in Minneapolis, Prince from Minneapolis conference at the University of Minnesota. I actually had the honor of presenting a paper there on Prince's eschatology in his 1999 album, as well as Purple Rain. So talked about themes of the end times and the second coming of Christ as themes in his music. And that was a very, very humbling experience. And I was very honored to be able to do it. So, and speaking of the Purple Rain conference from 2017, Kirsty, you and Mike actually co-edited a book based on the papers
We did. Yeah, it was released last year, and we hope that we'll have another book coming from this conference. And I don't know if Kristen's told you, but we are now establishing the International Center for Print Studies, so that we're working together with a number of universities internationally to really bring all this scholarship together. You know, it feels like it needs a home, and yeah, we're thrilled to be kind of propelling that forward. And yeah, there's so much more print scholarship to come. We know, don't we? There's so much more. And Mike and I currently have a call for papers for new essays on the box set on Standard Times box set. So yeah, that's out at the moment. So yeah, we had a number of papers submitted, so we're looking forward to editing that special issue of the journal.
Including from our host today, Papers Funnel.
Indeed, yes.
Yes.
Very, very,
Indeed.
very exciting. I wasn't going to mention it because I don't want to sound self-absorbed or narcissistic, but
No.
yes, I have submitted an abstract, so I'm
Yeah.
hoping it all works out. But yeah, the International Center for Print Studies sounds like a great, great thing, and I'm so honored and happy to have connected with you, Dr. Fairclough, and I hope you'll keep me in the loop as far as the progress of the center. And I
Yeah.
would like to be involved in any capacity I possibly could be. I'm an independent scholar. I haven't really done any formal university study in about 6 years or so, but with all the academic things going on surrounding prints and print studies, it's something that I'm very passionate about and very interested in. So yeah, I would definitely like to be a part of that world going
Yeah,
forward.
we'll absolutely keep you informed, Chris. Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
I want to give a shout out to Kirsty and Mike for the vision that they've always had, like she mentioned, about having the fans involved. I mean, it is humbling to me and amazing to me how passionate and knowledgeable and insightful Prince fans are. This has to be, like she was saying, something that the fans are part of the discussion and the dialogue. And that's why having Kirsty with her background in popular culture is such a perfect fit, to sort of keep the fans really engaged at this level. So she's awesome. I just wanted to give
Thank you, so are
that
you. It's
shout
an absolute pleasure to work with you, Kristen, every day.
Right, because to me, the fans are actually an essential part of his legacy going forward. It's
Yeah.
up to us to continue to carry his message and his goals in that he had in this life, with his platform and his celebrity. It's up to us to carry those forward. So that's our mission,
Yeah.
and I believe that these two ladies with me today resonate with that statement. I know I do. And yeah, that's what I try to do with this podcast. I try to bring people on that have important stories to tell, important contributions to make, and that have been doing great work, as Prince said in his 2001 song, people that are willing to do the work, willing to do the heavy lifting to ensure that his legacy not only survives but prospers. So, very great work both you ladies are doing, and I'm very, very honored to have you with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Absolute pleasure. All right. You take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So yeah, we were talking about the fun places. So those were a couple discoveries, and then I think the other sort of big takeaway that I, because I started this research in 2016, shortly after he passed away, and Prince was obviously when he first sort of emerged on the scene, you know, he famously didn't talk to the press for a lot of the time, or when he did, he was often obfuscating like his story, you know, telling one reporter my dad was Black, my mom's Italian, and then telling another reporter the opposite. And, you know, you never knew what you could take as sort of a reliable piece of information from some of those early interviews. But the sort of puzzling out of his movement between his childhood home, which is at 2628th Avenue North, the one that I found after I realized the Newton House wasn't, you know, where he was as a younger child. He moved into the 8th Avenue North house just before his 7th birthday. And then like how he ends up at Andre's house when he's, you know, an older teenager. And that whole time period was often really glossed over by other biographies of Prince. And of course, you know, if you looked at what Prince said himself, it got a little confuddled. So that was probably the most challenging part. And again, this is where I tried to rely on property records, divorce decrees, city directories to sort of piece together the sequence of events. And it was it was a little bit different than what often was portrayed in these books. And I mean when I'm trying to talk about like his childhood experiences, I mean, I really try hard not to, especially when some of my research is showing things maybe are a little different than what the previous narrative had been. Right. There's two examples I can think of. One is, you know, the Prince's relationship with school desegregation, and, you know, the sacrifice of Victor. We're familiar with, you know, the words about being a political tool, parents driving the kids to school to, you know, I'm forgetting the exact wording, but, you know, putting the babies together to eliminate the fear. He quotes 1967. And so a lot of people talk about Prince's school experience in relation to he was part of this, you know, desegregation efforts, which generally is a true statement. But when you really dive into like the history of what was going on at that time in 1960, so Minneapolis public schools had been technically desegregated since like the 1880s. But in reality, so, you know, a student could go to whatever school sort of they wanted to, and it was against the law to segregate schools. But what happened in reality was that as African-Americans moved here, especially during the Great Migration, when they were leaving the Jim Crow South and, you know, the apartheid type structure there, they come to Minneapolis to experience de facto segregation. You know, there's housing covenants. My house, built in 1940, the original abstract still has the, you know, the wording on it saying that basically only Caucasians can live here. So African-Americans couldn't live wherever they wanted to. So, you know, we end up with very distinct neighborhoods forming in Minneapolis, the North Side, the South Side, the Seven Corners area. Of course, these all play into Prince's music and movies, you know, some of these neighborhoods. So we end up with de facto school segregation because people are living in certain areas and most people are going to just send their kids to the neighborhood schools. So we end up with this, again, sort of de facto school segregation. And by the 1960s, you know, the public was starting to say to Minneapolis, like, you need to do more to get more diversity in your schools and, you know, allow students to go to different schools. And all that the city did in 1967 was to say, well, parents, if you want your kids to go to a different school, we will bus them for you, but it's totally voluntary. It wasn't part of a like citywide effort to just, you know, say we are now desegregating and these kids are going to go here. So at the time in 67, there was very few families who took advantage of that voluntary program. The Nelson family, his parents, John and Maddie, were one of the very few in that Northside neighborhood who chose to participate. From what I've seen, there was only about 20 kids. And so he was bused from, you know, he would have been going to John Hay. He was bused to Kenwood. And, you know, he talks obviously about, you know, the difficulty of that being one of the few Black kids in the Kenwood school. So again, my research is not trying to say that Prince didn't, you know, experience the effects of school desegregation, but there's a nuance here, right? That when he experienced that, it was his parents making this choice. Taika talks about it in her book, Mama Never Taught Me to Sing, which I don't know if you've read that, but it's very interesting. And she talks about how her parents wanted her and Prince to have more opportunity. And so they sort of, you know, took part in this voluntary program. By the time Prince, you know, that lasts for 1 year, his fourth grade year, fifth grade, he goes back to his neighborhood school at John Hay. Next year, he goes right next door to the Lincoln Junior High for his sixth grade year. But then for seventh grade, he's down at Bryant, which is in the city's south side. And it always struck me, I thought, why would the desegregation effort be to take a student from a predominantly African-American junior high on the city's north side down to the south side? It didn't seem to be part of a desegregation effort, and it wasn't. In 1970, there still was no formal desegregation going on here. That didn't happen until 1972. Well, in 1970, why is Prince on the south side going to Bryant? Well, at the time I first started this research, you know, we didn't have his beautiful, but, you know, very bittersweet, partially finished autobiography. But what my research showed during that was that, you know, he left the childhood home after his mother got remarried to Haywood Baker. He lived with his father at the apartment on Glenwood, but there wasn't enough room. And Prince wanted to go to Bryant because it had a very strong music program. So, you know, he moves to the south side to live with his aunt Olivia in a house right around the corner from Bryant. So again, this narrative is showing Prince not so much as like a victim of, you know, a desegregation program. It's him, as we know he is, a smart, driven individual who is trying to take advantage of, you know, programs and opportunities to advance his music career. That's why he goes to Bryant. And that's basically what he says in his autobiography, right? That there's too much testosterone on the north side. He wanted to get away from that. So those are the types of narratives where, again, I'm not trying to be like, oh, you know, desegregation wasn't a big deal and all that. It's just, I'm trying to get at those more nuanced details so that, you know, we see Prince for the driven person that he was, as opposed to the sort of other narrative.
Right. I mean, it's a question of truth, right? It's a question of transparency. It's a question of sort of demystifying the legend that he created and getting at the truth. So I definitely understand that. I definitely can resonate with that. As I said earlier in your introduction, you also give tours of Minneapolis. Is there a website or somewhere that people can look for more information on those tours?
Sure, and actually the timing is great for this. Most of the time I've done them, I volunteer with a group called Preserve Minneapolis. So they're a local advocacy group trying to, you know, work for preserving historic places in the city of Minneapolis. It's interesting, they've primarily focused on like architecture, you know, walking tours to look at pretty mansions and that, all that kind of stuff. But after they heard of my research, they asked if I would, you know, do this sort of more social history focus around popular culture things. And we used to do them as in-person walking tours, but then obviously when COVID hit last year, we did switch to an online platform, which has its benefits, right? Because you can go to more places than you can on a, you know, in-person tour. So we're doing that again this year, and it's going to be on June 6th from 11 to 1 Central Standard Time. So if people just Google preserveminneapolis.org and then go to their summer tours, this is going to be the first one to kick off the season. And we're going to, you know, explore the city together. I'll show pictures of these places, tell some of the stories. I also, you know, hopefully soon when the world kind of opens up again, I would like to start doing in-person tours again. And right now I don't have anything formal. Sometimes if people are just in town or they just want to, I'll just take them around because I love talking about Prince and showing. It's interesting, you know, having lived here for most of my life and sort of having a knowledge of the geography of the Twin Cities ever since I've started doing this research, my focus has changed. I now drive around and think, oh, that's where Prince recorded at Sound 80, and this is where Prince's childhood home was. I think of it in reference to these Prince landmarks. So, you know, if you have fans listening that just want to reach out, I'll probably just take them around because that's what I like to do. So, but check out preserveminneapolis.org and you can partake in the online tour.
Yeah, and I'll have that link for people. If you're watching on YouTube, I'll have the link in the description box for the video, so you'll be able to click on that and go right to it. If you're listening on Blog Talk Radio, of course, we have the Purple Nights Podcast Facebook page. So if you know that link, I'll be posting the Preserve Minneapolis link on the Purple Nights Podcast Facebook page. So you'll be able to find it wherever you partake of this podcast. So lastly, I wanted to sort of ask you with your work with Prince Academia in the recent times, are you thinking of maybe writing a book of your own in the future?
Yes. I've long thought about doing that. And well, as you know, Chris, recently somebody did take some of my work and tried to put it into a book without my knowing of it, right? There was somebody who apparently tried to plagiarize some of my work. And I thought, you know, I guess if people think it's good enough to plagiarize it, maybe I should get around to writing something. So yeah, I do have this vision of, and I'm working with a dear friend of mine who is also involved in the Prince from Minneapolis conference, and she did the People's Museum for Prince. I don't know if you ever saw that, where she sort of inverts the curatorial lens. Emma Blagel, I can never say her last name, I apologize. And she and I were both doing this research of Prince places, like sort of parallel at the same time. And then we met at one of the talks that I was giving for the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, and she and I just bonded together. And we've talked about trying to get a book proposal together to talk about, you know, this geography of Prince and what do these places mean? What is it, you know, maybe get stories from other people who've traveled to Minneapolis almost like in a pilgrimage type way and what it means to come to Minneapolis. What does it mean to see these places? So we are exploring that option. I've never written a book before, so it's a little daunting, but why not?
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I wish you all the success in the world with that. And, you know, talking about giving tours, it put me in mind right away to one of my dearest online friends. We haven't met in person yet, but we've known each other since St. Patrick's Day of 2007. So our friendship has been going on a long time. We haven't met in person yet because, of course, I'm in the Midwest, Minnesota now, these days, and she's all the way up in Pennsylvania. But for years now, she's had the goal of coming to Minneapolis and visiting all the purple sites, all the historic bridge sites. And I told her that my sister and I would be happy to accompany her on a tour of those sites. But we might do well to hook up with you and get a tour from you, because I know you've done a lot of in-depth work, a lot of valuable work, and you have very good knowledge and insight of these places. So
I'd be honored to join you. Tell her to come on out. We'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to get her. I've been trying to convince her to come out for years, and I'm tenacious like a bulldog, so I don't really let up very easily. So that'll keep going on until eventually, hopefully, she shows up here someday soon, within the next year or two. But yeah, I'm definitely hoping to tour the sites with her, and would love to connect with you to work something out with that. So
that would be great. I would love that.
Yeah, that would be awesome. So I very much appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing sharing stories of your research and your thoughts. And I'm very grateful to have made this connection with you. And I hope we can connect in the future and keep talking. And of course, I'll be there to lend you moral support with the undertaking of your book. I'll be one of the first ones in line to purchase the book when it does come out. So I'm very, very excited for that. And I was going to say a similar thing to Kirsty, but it slipped my mind while she was here. The book that she co-edited, I haven't gotten my hands on it yet, but I plan on getting that as well. So there'll be a link in the description box and also on the podcast to order the book, as well as the link to the upcoming conference, Prints 78 to 88. So yeah, lots of cool Prints related things to check out. And I'm so grateful to have done this podcast. Two great ladies doing great work. So I'm honored to be a part of that in some small way. So I'm Chris Johnson. For myself and Kristen Schumbler, I would like to say thank you very much for tuning in on YouTube, or if you're listening on Blog Talk Radio or Apple Podcasts, thank you very much. And until next time, I'll see you later, everybody. Thank you so much.